largest and second largest reserve holder of oil and natural gas, respectively, in 2020. At the end of 2020, Iran accounted for 25% of oil reserves in West Asia and 12% in the world. Despite its abundant reserves, Iran's crude oil production has fallen since 2017 because the oil sector has been subject to underinvestment and international sanctions for several years.
What to you? Worst case scenario.
Iran must consider the worst case scenario and see how it can move towards neutralization of the sanctions and not their removal. The removal of sanctions means engaging in talks like the 2015 Iran nuclear deal to suspend the sanctions, a move that carries a high degree of uncertainty. This is because the suspension of sanctions has to be confirmed every 6 months by an executive order from the US president, which involves a certain degree of uncertainty. The Islamic Republic must move towards the neutralization of the sanctions, something that the current administration in Iran is pursuing. This means we have to nullify the effects of the sanctions.
Although Iran is a member of OPEC, it is exempt from the production cuts under the OPEC Plus agreement, because its crude oil production remains limited by U.S.-imposed nuclear-related sanctions. Iran's crude oil production reached a 30-year low in 2020 as a result of these sanctions and the impacts of the global COVID-19 pandemic. EIA assesses that Iran's production could return to full capacity at 3.8 million barrels per day if the United States lifts oil sector sanctions. Iranian oil production is now about 2 million to 2.5 million BPD, with around 2 million BPD allocated to domestic refineries and roughly 500,000 BPD to exports, a source close to the oil ministry said. Iran and the leading world powers have been in talks since earlier this year to revive the nuclear pact and have held several rounds of negotiations, which have been inconclusive so far. Iran remains hopeful that it would be able to reinstate its oil production to pre-sanctions levels once the sanctions are lifted by the U.S.
Increased demand for winter occurs mainly in summer because oil purchase contracts are long-term contracts of 3 to 6 months, and purchase and sale contracts for most of the oil supplied in winter and cold seasons are made and arranged in the previous month. So the effects of the entry to the cold seasons have already been felt, and if there are any purchases or sales, they'll before the coming warmer seasons. Therefore, the effects of cold seasons on the global oil market and the increased demand, and in turn increased prices, have already been felt. We are already experiencing the results of those factors.
Despite all difficulties like the coronavirus pandemic and U.S. sanctions, the Iranian oil and gas industry has been developing at a rapid pace. Various sectors of Iran's oil and gas industry, including exploration, production, processing, and distribution, are all among the world's top rankings, and the country is taking new steps to develop the industry even further. To what extent would you say Iran's oil industry is independent? Is it sufficiently so?
They can also push for the lifting of these sanctions, for example, Turkey and Iraq. Iraq has a contract with us for another 2 years. Turkey has had a 25-year contract with us, which is now getting expired. But if these events had not happened in the gas market, and they could have replaced LNG. Right now, the Turks are one of the buyers of LNG from the United States. They have tried to cover their shortages by buying LNG from Qatar and the United States. Now that prices have risen so much, they all seem to be interested in renewing their long-term contracts with Iran. On the other hand, the high prices of gas put pressure on the demand for petroleum products. Now many power plants that have been using gas are likely to prefer to use petroleum products as gas prices soared.
Among different sectors of this industry, refining is a major one which is seriously attractive for development. According to OG, the country's daily oil refining capacity will increase by 1.5 times to 3.5 million barrels in the near term. Besides its huge crude production capacities, Iran is also a leading supplier of natural gas with a current production of over 1 million cubic meters per day. Therefore, gas refinery development is also being pursued as a high priority. Bit Boland refinery in the southwest of Iran is an outstanding example. The refinery, which was inaugurated in mid-January, has a daily processing capacity of more than 56 million cubic meters of associated gas, and when operating at full capacity, it will generate 700 million of revenue every year. As the largest gas refinery project in West Asia, Bit Boland will have an annual production capacity of 10.4 million tons of methane, 1.5 million tons of ethane, 1 million tons of propane, 600,000 tons of gas condensates, and 500,000 tons of butane.
Speaking of self-sufficiency, there are several issues to consider. One is the products, in which case we can confidently say that we are self-sufficient in refining and producing gas and petroleum products. In terms of self-sufficiency in the engineering of oil projects, construction, pipelines, drilling, making offshore platforms, and so on, we are in a much better situation compared to other oil producers. We are in an acceptable position when it comes to equipment too. There are 700 to 800 Iranian companies that are manufacturing oil industry equipment and have taken some very good steps.
That's all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same time next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. More than 400 international health organizations and professionals representing two-thirds of the global healthcare workforce have signed an open letter calling on politicians to consider the health benefits of climate action ahead of the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Veronica Sterzeniska. The piece is titled World Leaders Urge to Consider Health Benefits of Climate Action. More than 400 international health organizations and professionals representing two-thirds of global healthcare workers have signed an open letter calling on politicians to consider the health benefits of climate action ahead of the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland. We know that climate change is impacting people's health. This is increasingly visible around the world. We also know that many solutions to address climate change offer tremendous health co-benefits, said Dr. Jenny Miller of Global Climate and Health Alliance, the organization which drafted the open letter. The health community is really seeing that if we don't step up and call for action on climate change, we're failing the patients and the communities that we care for. The letter lists 7 million premature deaths a year due to pollution and disturbance of global food systems by extreme weather as some of the health detriments caused by the climate crisis. It also argues that the costs of policies such as improving the cleanliness of air and water and creating more secure and food supplies would be offset by savings in healthcare costs. The appeal has also been signed by the Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, and coincides with the publication of a special report on climate and health by the World Health Organization, WHO. Pediatric healthcare providers from the United Kingdom will cycle from London to Glasgow with a copy of the report to officially present it to world leaders at the summit after the report is delivered to them by bike from Geneva. Dr. Dermot Campbell-Ledroom, the head of the World Health Organization Health and Climate Department, said. The report includes 10 recommendations and intends to offer positive encouragement to world leaders emphasizing the positive health effects of climate crisis mitigation, according to Dr. Campbell-Ledroom. We think that the report will boost the argument of any government or stakeholder around the world who is trying to encourage their population to get behind climate action, he said. These health gains are so large, they provide a compelling argument. Developing nations in the global south, which have historically contributed the least to greenhouse gas emissions, are among the areas where health is worst affected by the climate crisis, according to the report. Some of these small island developing states will within the next several decades be flooded by rising sea levels. There is no way that you can protect health of those populations if the country is submerged, Dr. Campbell-Ledroom said. Both the report and the open letter also stress the importance of a green recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. Countries have leveraged tremendous amounts of money to deal with the economic impacts of the pandemic, Dr. Miller said. Many of those investments are still going into propping up carbon-intensive industries. We're making this massive public investment into something which will bring about and exacerbate the unfolding health crisis that's driven by climate change. Paths to green recovery suggested by the report could include preventing public funds from going to fossil fuel industries, as well as dedicating funds to ensuring the same shift away from fossil fuel is possible in developing countries. For both COVID and the climate crisis, there is a need for coordinated global action because nobody is safe until everybody is safe, Dr. Dermot Campbell-Ledroom said. Meanwhile, a World Health Organization's special report warned on Monday, 11th of October, that climate change is the single biggest health threat facing humanity, and governments must act with urgency to tackle the crisis. A special World Health Organization report outlined major climate issues already affecting public health, including air pollution from burning of fossil fuels that causes climate change, more intense heat waves, floods and storms, extreme weather worsening food insecurity and hunger, and rising sea levels wrecking homes and livelihoods. According to a CNN report, Protecting health requires action well beyond the health sector, in energy sector, transportation sector, nature, food systems, finance, and more. The World Health Organization's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, wrote in the special report. The health arguments for rapid climate action have never been clearer, Tedros added. I hope this report can guide policymakers and practitioners from across sectors and across the world to implement the transformative changes that are needed. He said the report includes 10 recommendations that provide concrete examples of interventions that, with support, can be scaled up rapidly to safeguard our health and our climate. They included creating climate-resilient and environmentally sustainable health systems, sustainable food production, and designing sustainable cities and transportation systems. Even as they have been battling to end the COVID-19 pandemic, health leaders everywhere have been sounding the alarm on climate change. Maria Neira, director of the World Health Organization's Department of Environment, Climate Change and Health, said in a new release, "It is time that we listened."
Brothers in crime.
More than 100,000 men have been sexually assaulted in the U.S. military in recent decades. The U.S. military tolerates sexual harassment. The number of women in the military assaulted is also staggering. Commanders often ignore reports and punish the victims instead.
A video posted by a female Marine about sexual assault in the military rocketed across the internet and into the Pentagon press briefing room today. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin promised to take additional steps to stop such violence. But as Nick Schifrin reports, sexual assault in the military continues to rise, and individual families continue to be ripped apart.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. In this episode, we will explore heinous sexual crimes going on for years in the U.S. military, and it is not only against women. Thousands of men are sexually assaulted in the military and often do not report it. Stay tuned for more.
Sexual assault in the military has long been swept under the rug, covered up for rationalized acts of hazing or bullying, but now we're learning more about the men who were victimized during their time serving the country. Pentagon statistics show an average of 10,000 men each year are sexually assaulted in the U.S. military. Most of the victims are usually younger, lower-ranking males who struggle to report the incidents.
Nearly one in four U.S. service women reports being sexually assaulted in the military. The New York Times magazine calls it the epidemic of military sexual assault. Most assaults go unreported, and from the ones that do get reported, only a very small fraction end in a conviction. For instance, in 2020, there were 6,200 reports of offenses made, but only 50, which is less than 1%, ended in sex offense conviction.
According to the U.S. Department of Defense, 24% of women and 6% of men in the military endured severe, persistent sexual harassment. Of the small margin who actually tried to complain, the majority were told to drop the matter. Here with us is our first guest, Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Good to be with you.
All right, now, Scott, what is the situation of sexual assault like today in the U.S. military?
Well, the U.S. military has, in a way, been in a slow train wreck deconstruction demolition for the past 50 years, ever since the Vietnam War, and the American military, essentially from the Vietnam War before, was all men. After the Vietnam War, the military academies and the military services began to increasingly bring women in to roles that were previously not simply nursing or clerical, but actual physical involvement with duties that were very close to men in situations and scenarios. So as a result of the American military opening up a lot of its previously closed doors to women, you've had an increase steadily in the incidence of sexual harassment, sexual molestation, rape, also physical violence, and things like that.
Thank you for joining us on the program, Mr. Scott Bennett.
From 2009 to 2015, more than 22% of service members who left the military after reporting a sexual assault received a less than fully honorable discharge. This is according to a 2016 investigation by the Department of Defense's Office of the Inspector General.
That is nearly 1.5 times more than the percentage of overall service members who received less than fully honorable discharges from 2002 through 2013. Our second guest, Dr. Rick Stagenberg, is a retired Veterans Affairs psychiatrist who's now a social and political commentator and an activist for peace and universal health care in the U.S. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Now, what is a culture of the military which results in these assaults?
I think it's going to take, they're going to have to get serious about prosecuting the offenders before the other ones will think twice. I mean, because of the hierarchical nature of the military, it's very easy to fall into that, even people that might not otherwise, certainly not in civilian life, would not be assaulting their subordinates, seem to think they can get away with it. Violence is a way is considered normal in the military. So, I mean, in the Marines, part of the training is to, you know, get beaten and beat others until you're tougher. I understand that's changed some since I was in the military, but I doubt it's changed a lot. So it's a culture. It's going to be hard to change.
That was Dr. Rick Stagenberg there joining us. Thank you, sir.
Many service members leave the military soon after experiencing sexual trauma, and not voluntarily. Not only are military rapists rarely punished, but their victims are often punished for reporting what happened. According to a 2018 survey of active duty service members by the Department of Defense, 38% of service women who reported their assaults experienced professional retaliation afterward.
Morgan Robinson knew from a young age she wanted to join the military.
When she turned 21, she said, "Mom, I gotta talk to you." And she told me then that she had joined.
She'd been in the Army National Guard 6 years when she was sent on her first deployment to Kuwait in 2016.
What happened to Morgan while she was serving abroad?
When she was in Kuwait, she was sexually assaulted and continually harassed by one of her superiors.
Did she report it?
Yes, she reported it.
What was the response when she reported it?
Nothing. She got nothing.
While on that same deployment, Morgan was sent to Afghanistan, where she was sexually assaulted again, an alleged gang rape involving multiple fellow soldiers.
According to Deputy Director of the Defense Department's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office, for generations, the military wasn't looking for male sexual assault victims, so it failed to see them. Only in 2006, after the office began surveying service members, did the military learn that at least as many men as women were being assaulted.
Also in the military have joined the military to purposefully and intentionally bring in homosexuality into the military. This was done under Obama and also under Bill Clinton. So there has been, since the 1990s, a steady increase in homosexual members of the military. And that has created an environment where certain young men are groomed or in some cases lured into compromising positions by senior officers that may have more of a homosexual inclination. So you have a lot of those incidents.
A report published in May indicates that while the share of male victims who come forward has been rising recently, an estimated 4 out of 5 still do not report the attack. Why are so many men assaulted in the military?
Well, it's primarily because rape and sexual violence are crimes of aggression, not passion. That's a common mistake. When people are, how shall I say, well, people tend to become more callous after they've undergone military training, especially if they've been in combat.
Billy Joe Capshaw was 17 years old when he joined the Army and was stationed at Baumhalder Army Garrison in Germany in 1980 and was assigned to share a room with Jeffrey Dahmer, who was an Army medic and later came to be arrested in 1991 for being a serial rapist and killer. Jeffrey Dahmer had raped and killed 17 young men and boys, dismembered, and ate them. And during Capshaw's time in the military, he was constantly beaten, drugged, and raped by Dahmer, who never told anyone.
Shortly before midnight on July the 22nd, 1991, two Milwaukee police officers were flagged down in their patrol car by a man with a pair of handcuffs dangling from one wrist. The police had no idea that this bizarre encounter would lead to the arrest of one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history.
That night, people were afraid. People were whispering under their breaths, you know, it's the devil, it's the devil.
The man had escaped from a small one-bedroom apartment on North 25th Street. When the officers went to investigate, they found themselves in a living nightmare.
They saw the body parts, and then one of the officers said he heard a scream. Then he realized later he was the one who screamed when he saw the body.
Without detection, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer had killed 17 young men across a 13-year period.
One of the main reasons troops who are victims of sexual assault hardly ever see justice is the way in which such crimes are investigated and prosecuted. Under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the military commanders decide whether to investigate and follow legal action. Some politicians have been fighting and failing for years to change these military laws. We asked Dr. Stagenberg about the current situation.
Well, according to the report that came out in July, there has not been any improvement. I haven't seen specific statistics. But when I was working for the VA, it was pretty horrible. I saw most of the women I saw had been sexually traumatized one way or the other. And my impression that it's the same thing, but they are working on it.
Thank you, Doctor, and viewers, stay tuned for more.
Every year since 2013, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York has introduced legislation to move the decision to prosecute major military crimes, including sex crimes, out of the hands of commanders and into those of independent prosecutors. And every year it has failed to move forward.
The commanders, up until now, have been very reluctant to investigate these in many cases, if not most. And even when they do, they frequently punish the person who speaks. So it inhibits other people from reporting.
Historically, the Pentagon has vehemently opposed the idea, saying that it would undermine institutional leadership. During a 2019 Senate hearing, Vice Admiral John G. Hanning, Judge Advocate General of the Navy, testified that removing authority over serious crimes from commanders would have a detrimental impact on the ability of those commanders and other commanders to ensure good order and discipline.
Our Navy regulations emphasize the great responsibility of the commanding officer for his or her command. and it states that the authority of the commanding officer is commensurate with his or her responsibility. In my view, it must remain so, and this authority should not be eroded.
Sexual assault is often the initial signal event in a long line of painful trauma, which can culminate in post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and suicide. In a 2019 study, scientists surveyed more than 300 servicewomen and female veterans who had experienced sexual assault and found that 29% were currently contemplating suicide. Now, from 2007 to 2017, the age-adjusted suicide rate among women veterans rose by 73%. In 2019, women accounted for 31% of all suicide attempts among active duty service members.
I saw ones that were traumatized to the point where they had post-traumatic stress disorder. And again, I saw only a tiny proportion of the women that had been affected by that. Most of them just to try to bury it. They never even report it. If they do start suffering symptoms, they don't want to go to the VA because it's sort of a military style way of delivering services. It's kind of militarized in the way they run it. They're constantly praise the military and the heroes. And these women were victimized by some of those people that are called heroes. These women were victimized by people who were supposed to have their back. And when you think about it for a moment, you can see, obviously, when you're traumatized by the very people that are supposed to be trying to protect you, as you are protecting them, it's doubly bad.
Since military sexual assault triggers multiple traumas, victims repeatedly experience feelings of betrayal, isolation, and worthlessness. Surveys show that the environment in which women are assaulted in the military are atmospheres where women often feel that they don't belong in, and they are usually assaulted by the men they work with, and at times they are their direct superior. So they have to constantly see them and work with them, feeling that they might be assaulted again.
Many in the military who experience sexual harassment or being preyed upon or date rape or gang raped or in any way drugged, that's one of the very, very big dangers and problems, is the drugging of women that causes them to become incapacitated and thereby make them victims of sexual predators. Most of these women that experience this are very much ashamed and just want to forget it and don't want to draw attention. They don't want to draw any sort of investigation that could mar or blacken their character.
Many of the victims of sexual assault leave the military involuntarily. It is not just the rapist often goes unpunished, but the victim actually receives punishment for reporting the offense. According to a 2018 survey by the Department of Defense, 30% of servicewomen who reported assaults in the military received professional retaliation.
In December 2019, she arrived at Fort Bliss in Texas, an 18-year-old soldier.
She was a very, very proud soldier. And her basic trainings, First Sergeant loved her and praised her.
But she left the military draped in a flag. She'd been found dead on New Year's Eve 2020 in her barracks at age 19.
She got raped by a fellow soldier in December. She reported it in February. She was told to shut up. And the rapist was in her barracks, in her company, and she had to see him.
Graham moved in with her brother off base to get away from her alleged attacker. The siblings had always been close. Anthony saw his sister's descent. She started drinking and taking pills and became self-destructive. She got a DUI. She died of an overdose.
Many of the victims who decide to leave the military have not received a full honorable discharge. This is called a bad paper discharge, which can cut veterans off from jobs and VA services, as well as education benefits. The 2020 Veterans Legal Clinic report found that the VA has denied services to as many as 400,000 potentially eligible veterans.
So the military really isn't equipped, nor does it have the imperative to educate and morally train soldiers in relationship dimensions. That is one of the key areas that the American military family is left up to its own devices. Anything regarding morality, anything regarding sexual relationships or dating or any of these activities or just human relationships in general, the military does not engage that. The military is specifically inclined to training soldiers to perform specific tasks that fall within the military strategy of fighting wars, defeating enemies, and those are very limited training modules.
According to the New York Times, in group therapy, a woman named Jessica told the group that she had jumped off a second-floor balcony and shattered her pelvis to escape a Navy soldier who was trying to kill her. Another woman said that she was tied up, threatened with a razor blade, and raped in Japan on a Navy deployment when she was 19. She reported it the next day, but her assailant walked.
So it's a very complicated phenomenon, the nature of sexual relationships in the U.S. military, and it's a very sordid and ugly a problem in many, many regards. But it has been predictable because when the American military started opening up the doors and allowing and encouraging men and women to be working in close quarters and close situations, doing many of the same jobs, it was only inviting these problemed relationships and scenarios. And it also has depleted the America's combat effectiveness. And like I said, transformed the American military from a lethal war machine into now a social experiment.
Military-wide survey released back in 2019 reveals that alcohol use is a main contributing factor in sexual assaults and was involved in over 62% of these incidents against women. Assaults had increased across all branches of the military, but the Marine Corps, which has more young, low-ranking troops and far less women than other services, reported by far the highest rates of assaults. 10% of women surveyed in the Marines reported being assaulted, which is twice the rate of either the Army or the Air Force.
The results obtained by USA Today estimated 20,500 incidents of unwanted sexual contact involving personnel from the four armed forces branches in 2018. The study defined the range for assault as groping to rape. According to USA Today, the study showed that 85% of sexual assault victims knew their assailant, and in 62% of cases, alcohol was involved.
This survey indicated that the rate of assaults on men in the military was far less than on women. About 1% of men surveyed said they had been assaulted in the previous year, with the highest incidents recorded in the Navy. Even though, according to the survey, troops were experiencing more assaults, they were less likely than before to report them.
You know, a lot of people were thrown out of the military and had their entire identity taken away. So whatever trauma they were going through just from being assaulted was compounded because they were fired. They were sent home, often under a cloud of shame. This oftentimes happened, you know, when people were 19, 20 years old, right when they're trying to form their identity, and it really sent them sprawling. So, you know, men that I spoke to who were assaulted in the 1960s and 70s, they spent decades trying to hide this, even oftentimes from themselves, and the damage to their lives was tremendous.
The staggering number of sexual violence, assault, and harassment on both men and women in the U.S. military more than anything shows the lack of ethics and moral character in the country's most important force of imperialism.
The United States military and many of its bases around the world, such as Okinawa, the Philippines, Germany, the U.S. military has also had many of its members engage in the rape, molestation, unwanted attention of the local female population. From Korea to Japan to Germany, there are many, many incidents of U.S. military members going off of base and going to bars or other places and engaging in very immoral activities and also in outright criminal activities. So this has been a source of animosity and friction among many of the countries in which the U.S. has positioned itself and had bases. The Japanese in Okinawa have reacted with a great deal of hostility and political protest.
These actions also show the weakness that lurks among soldiers, officers, and superior officers who are either perpetrators or involved in the cover-up of such heinous crimes against the weak.
Crimes that are also inflicted upon communities and countries where the military is stationed for one reason or another and is often harshly criticized by governments and people who are hosting them. These soldiers who have no mercy on their fellow comrades will obviously have no mercy on ordinary foreign citizens either. Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 16 of Surah Qaf.
وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ وَنَعْلَمُ مَا تُوَسْوِسُ بِهِ نَفْسُهُ وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ حَبْلِ الْوَرِيدِ.
And certainly we have created man, and we know to what his soul tempts him, and we are nearer to him than his jugular vein. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last Friday, We had said that in debates with the deniers of truth, we should apply the rationality of the cross-questioning method in order to awaken their minds and guide them to the ultimate truth. In view of the fact that those who do not believe in the day of resurrection have no logic and only express their doubts. The ayah that we recited to you refers to Almighty God's omniscience in knowing every minute thing, including the future, and his majestic attributes of originating creation. Thus, the Creator is all aware of the outward and inward qualities and deeds of his creatures, and is fully aware that the disbeliever's denial of resurrection springs from deviation and temptations, despite the fact that their innate natural disposition is aware of their origin. It means to say that if only the deniers of resurrection made use of their God-given reason, they would have resisted satanic temptations and acknowledged the veracity of resurrection without entertaining any doubts as to the same. In other words, Allah created human beings, and thus, as the Almighty Creator, he is aware of mankind's inherent weaknesses. He gave mankind intellect, consciousness, and free will. As for the phrase, nearer than the jugular vein, it implies that Allah knows more truly the innermost state of every person's feelings and consciousness than does that person. The Arabic word warid means the vein is connected to the heart and liver through which blood flows, while waridan are applied to the twin blood vessels connecting the heart to the brain on which the body depends for survival. It is one of the closest things to a person's life, since if blood flow suffers from any defect, the person will die. Thus, since existence of every person depends upon God Almighty, he is closer to us than our jugular vein that keeps us alive. Such closeness reflects that God Almighty is closer to us than anything else, and consequently aware of anything, even thoughts and intentions that flash across our mind, as well as temptations occurring in our hearts. The All-Merciful, however, does not punish mankind for evil intentions and thoughts, unless these are turned into action. This ayah teaches us that, number one, the Almighty Creator's knowledge and power are infinite, and everything is in his control. Which means, if a person thinks that God is unaware of his thoughts, he is in grossly mistaken. Number two, like our bodily organs, we should take proper care of our soul in order to prevent it from falling prey to satanic temptations. Now let's listen to ayahs 17 and 18 of this surah.
إذ يتلقى المتلقيان عن اليمين وعن الشمال قعيد ما يلفظ من قول إلا لديه رقيب عتيد.
When the twin recorders record a person's deeds, seated on the right hand and the left, he says no word, but that there is a ready observer beside him. These ayahs means that divine omniscience, in order to document every person's inward and outward deeds, has assigned two angels to keep records that can never be refuted on the resurrection day. The two angels do not actually sit on the right, but always accompany a person from both angels to keep detailed record of deeds, even noting down every single word uttered. God the All-Merciful, however, has instructed the angels that in case of a bad deed or bad words, to grant the said person some hours before noting them down in order to provide ample opportunity for repentance and seeking forgiveness. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, although God is all aware of our inward and outward deeds, words, and thoughts, He has assigned angels for every person so that all actions and intentions are recorded as documented proof. Number two, it is obvious that our human eyes are not designed to perceive angels who are invisible, since their essence of creation is different from that of all earthly creatures. And number three, every person is responsible for not only his or her deeds, but for words uttered. So we ought to be careful and desist from evil actions or verbal expression that unjustly cause harm to others and to our own selves because of bad behavior. Now we recite to you ayahs 19, 20, 21, and 22 of Surah Qaf as the concluding ayahs of this week's episode.
وَجَاءَتْ سَكْرَةُ الْمَوْتِ بِالْحَقِّ ذَلِكَ مَا كُنْتَ مِنْهُ تَحِيدُ وَنُفِخَ فِي الصُّورِ ذَلِكَ يَوْمُ الْوَعِيدِ وجاءت كل نفس معها سائق وشهيد لقد كنت في غفلة من هذا فكشفنا عنك غطاءك فبصرك اليوم حديد.
When the agony of death brings the truth, this is what you used to shun. Then the trumpet will be blown. This is the promised day. Then every person will come forth on the scene of resurrection accompanied by two angels, that is, a driver pushing forward and a witness testifying all words and deeds. You were certainly oblivious of this. We have removed your veil from you, and so your sight is acute today. At the moment of death, every person loses his or her consciousness. It means the stupor of death, accompanied by agony and loss of consciousness, is the moment of truth which people had tried in vain to evade. The next stage will be the resurrection of every person, heralded with the blowing of the great trumpet for the final judgment on the day that had been promised and foretold by all prophets of God, but ignored by the disbelievers. Blowing the trumpet here refers to its second blowing, since, according to the Noble Quran and Hadith, the first blowing of the trumpet will cause every person to perish, and no creature shall remain alive. Thus, upon the second blowing of the trumpet, all creatures find a new life and all the dead human beings emerge from their graves, even those whose bodies had been mutilated, burnt, and the ashes scattered will be assembled in their original form. Ayah 21 means to tell the disbelievers that no one may escape or deny reckoning on Judgment Day, as the two angels assigned for every person drive that person to the divine tribunal and read out from the documented record of deeds. The next ayah refers to the words of the angels, who tell the disbelievers in their custody, "This is the day against which you were warned by the prophets, but you were heedless. Today, the veils are removed from your eyes and your sight is sharp. You see what you used to disbelieve and deny." In other words, all transgressors and disbelievers shall have a clear vision to see the consequences of their evil, which they could not perceive or deemed improbable during their life on earth. In contrast to the miserable fate of the disbelievers, hypocrites, and the sinners who face divine wrath, the souls of the believers at the time of their death willingly turn toward the other world, and the angel of death will bear to them the glad tidings of paradise on its bounties. Divine mercy will be bestowed upon believers, and veils will be cast from their eyes, and they will see the abodes prepared for them. From these ayahs we'll learn that, number one, there is no escape from death for any person or creature. Number two, the agony of death will occur to every human being, since the fear of death and anxiety of its aftermath make them, especially the disbelievers, lose their senses. Number three, it is the negligence of afterlife that causes people to indulge in worldly greed, pleasures, and oppression of the rights of others. And number four, the mortal world acts as a veil and prevents human from perceiving facts and realities, but on the day of resurrection these veils are removed and every person will realize the plain truth.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Opening a defense exhibition in Pyongyang, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un maintained the arms on display provide deterrence, and that it's the United States and South Korea which engage in destabilizing and threatening behavior. Their hypocritical attitude and the U.S. tacit sponsorship continue to damage inter-Korean relations, and their unlimited dangerous attempts to strengthen military capability are disrupting the balance of power in the region, aggravating military instability. North Korea has recently